Part 2, mayonnaise sandwich.
Have you ever wondered how they made a mayonnaise sandwich 25 years ago?
Take a loaf of white bread, open a jar of mayonnaise, put as much mayonnaise as possible.
Well, I'm here to tell you that some things never change. I'm Kerry Thompson, and I found so many great stories from the NPR archives of April 1985 that the full mayonnaise sandwich recipe did not make it into this episode of Playback. This month, we feature some really good stories, including one format breaker, which in radio talk means big honkin' long piece. In this case, we bring you the fabulous radio documentary, Goodbye Saigon.
On this last day of the war, helicopter pilot Van de Geer was on the aircraft carrier Midway, waiting with other American helicopter pilots for orders to begin the evacuation.
I really didn't have a good idea why I was being recalled. I had no clear idea as to what was going on. But we felt as though it had something to do with Saigon.
The evacuation of Saigon and the story of helicopter pilot Richard Van de Geer on the last day of the Vietnam War, April 30th, 1975. You know, it just wouldn't be right if I weren't able to bring you at least a few value-added vintage snippets of stories from April 85. Besides, I'm partial to them because they sound like the 80s. Here's one that will go really well with that mayonnaise sandwich. Spokesmodel Vanna White from the TV show Wheel of Fortune talks about getting her first big break.
I auditioned along with several hundred other girls. It was just one of those opportunities that came along, and I thank God for it.
And now please join me in welcoming our hostess. Here is Vanna White. Oh, Vanna!
That's Pat Sajak, the man who gave up a promising career as a TV weatherman to spin the Wheel of Fortune.
You know, the greatest thing about this job, really, I mean, aside from the fact that I make tons of money and have a soft schedule, is that I get to throw my clothes on the floor, on a chair. You can see it there. I just toss my clothes, and someone comes and picks up my clothes. It's the greatest thing. Just for that alone, I would not give up this job.
Game show host Pat Sajak, a man who did not believe in putting it in the biz bag. And here's a fun fact. Did you know that Pat Sajak served in Vietnam as a DJ for Armed Forces Radio? It's true. Though I'm pretty sure he did not have a valet at the time.
Gift tax gets you when you're on. Death tax gets you when you're gone. The cops come get you if you don't pay taxes, taxes, taxes.
And what would April be without taxes? And a visit from funny guy Tom Baudet.
That's taxes, taxes, taxes. Utah, Ogden, Utah. You know there's nothing that I'd rather do than send my savings book to you, Ronald and Nancy Reagan. Now you can eat filet mignon and decorate your Pentagon. So send those checks and money orders from Alaska down to Florida and get yourself right back to work for taxes, taxes, taxes.
And in addition to taxes, there was talk of yuppies, the young urban kind. And NPR commentator Ian Scholes did not like them one bit.
Yuppie anguish, there's a concept for the 80s, but whatever else you can call yuppies, you can't really call them self-pitying. No, sir, they love themselves, what they buy, what other yuppies are buying. They love to read about themselves, dress for success, in search of excellence. It's the new materialism, and if there's any guilt attached, it's only to spice up the profit-making process. Otherwise, yuppies would be perfect beings, and only God, or maybe Ted Turner, is perfect. The new materialism has generated a new sexuality. Look at Madonna, for example. I have a hard time looking at her myself, but the boy toy is the material girl for this modern material world. It's been said that she exploits cheap male fantasies when she dresses in those silly clothes, sings her silly songs in that silly little girl voice. But
sounds like Ian Scholes needed a little We Are the World to counteract that new materialism. We got a dose of it this year in January 2010 when they brought it back as We Are the World 25, urging people to help with the earthquake relief efforts in Haiti. Here's an abridged story about the original.
At this moment, thousands of radio stations around the world are playing one song. Muzak is even feeding it to elevators and dentist offices. 46 American musicians recorded this song in a Los Angeles studio on January 28th. And today, We Are the World is a music industry phenomenon, at the top of the music charts, earning millions for African relief. The song was conducted and produced by Quincy Jones and written by Michael Jackson and Lionel Richie, who sings the first words.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one. There are people dying.
It's really hard to fade out of that, but I must to bring you this very late breaking news from April 1st, 1985. Here's Bob Edwards.
It's a busy time for media magnate Rupert Murdoch, owner of the New York Post, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Times of London, and many other publications throughout the world. The Australian publisher has just purchased a 50% interest in the 20th Century Fox Film Studios. And now there are rumors that Murdoch, whose publications are often accused of being racy and sensational, is preparing a bid to purchase National Public Radio. NPR's Scott Simon reports.
There's been so much attention and analysis devoted to Mr. Murdoch's purchase of stock in 20th Century Fox that rumors of his attempt to take control of the 309-station Washington-based public radio system may have been obscured. First news was probably heard last Wednesday, this almost casual-sounding notice on the World Service of the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Ipswich, 6, Islington, 4. In financial news today, the Australian publishing magnate, Mr. Rupert Murdoch, is reported to be preparing a bid for the purchase of the National Public Radio System, a non-profit radio network in the United States. Mr. Murdoch, who already owns...
Jim Middleton has closely chronicled Rupert Murdoch's bids, raids, and boardroom marauding over the years. He's now Washington Bureau Chief for the Australian Broadcasting Commission. Jim Middleton explains why a businessman of Mr. Murdoch's wealth might want to purchase a comparatively small, comparatively impoverished public radio system.
Good question, good question. I'd say probably two reasons. Naked ambition would have to be one. And the other, I think, would be, you know, very simply summed up by the phrase tax loss.
The media critics by surprise.
Ron Powers is a Pulitzer Prize-winning media critic, now a novelist and commentator for the CBS television program Sunday Morning.
This is a time in Rupert Murdoch's career, Scott, to really make a personal statement. I think that the sheer prospect of ordering Susan Stamberg to do an 8-part series on thrill goddesses of the ERA is probably irresistible.
But to other media analysts and critics, any partnership between Rupert Murdoch has become known for seemingly relentless promotion and often sensational street sign-sized headlines, and National Public Radio, which has won awards for a more subdued, soft-voiced approach, sounds almost inconceivable. But Robert Siegel, who's NPR's director of news, doesn't believe a purchase of his network by Rupert Murdoch would necessarily bring about serious editorial changes.
Nothing very major, Scott. I'm very hopeful that this could mark an occasion for... mainstreaming, shall we say, some of the more serious journalistic interests of National Public Radio with some of the more mass cultural subject areas in which Mr. Murdoch's newsrooms are expert.
Well, what specifically could that wind up being, though?
Oh, I would think we would do a little bit more work about astrology, life after death, cancer cures, Johnny Carson's divorce.
So just this past week, NPR staff began to put together a pilot for the kind of programming they might produce under Rupert Murdoch's ownership.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. I'm Susan Stamberg.
And this is Noah Adams with All Things Considered.
Mainstreaming, as Robert Siegel terms it, the network's traditional news and public affairs reporting with Mr. Murdoch's more pointed approach.
She was the most beautiful dancer in the whole club. Sweet, real innocent, like. And now... she's got no place to hang her hat. Real sad. I think the Russians did it.
Headless body in topless bar. We'll have a report.
Also, these stories, should clergy get free gender-changing operations in state-supported hospitals? A debate between author Jan Morris and theologian Hans Kung.
Speaking of theology, has Bernhard Goetz ever seen a UFO? We'll find out what you think.
Duran Duran tells us why the proposed value-added tax is a bad idea.
Marry the girl, Alex. That's the advice our commentator John McLaughlin gives to ballet star Alexander Goodenough about his arrangement with actress Jacqueline Bisset.
And Cindy Lauper wrestles with this idea. Is the ANZUS Mutual Defense Pact outdated?
That and more tonight on All Things Considered. First, this roundup of the day's celebrity and lifestyle news.
This is Brian Naylor. Well, it's April 1st, 1985. Venus is the star ascending. Astrological analysts report that because President Reagan is an Aquarius and Soviet leader Mikhail...
Any successful takeover depends upon the cooperation of NPR's 309 local member stations, and reaction there has been mixed. Ken Davis, program director at WBEZ in Chicago, chooses these words.
Shocked and appalled. I'm absolutely disgraced by this entire thing, and I don't even want to be a part of it.
Uh-huh. Well, the projections that some of the financial people are making is that a station as large as yours in the system might appreciate something on the order of $2-2.5 million if NPR were to be purchased by Mr. Murdoch.
I think that it's important at a time like this, when there are major crises, that we be objective. And certainly it wouldn't be appropriate to jump to massive conclusions about Mr. Murdoch. Certainly there may be a place for him in the system, and we have to look at all sides of the issue.
Mr. Murdoch's organization absolutely denies and rejects any interest in the purchase of National Public Radio. Sources there point out such a bid may even be prohibited by law. But to some modern marketing experts and audience researchers, the partnership seems commercially sensible. Sandra Nicolini is marketing director for the Sperling, Carpian, and Lowe agency in New York City.
Your network, yeah, finally getting heard by a group larger than the same number of people who voted against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, yeah, it's a beautifully harmonious relationship. I mean, both for Rupert Murdoch and RPN.
That's NPR, by the way. In the minds of some people who are already listeners to the programs of National Public Radio, there is some concern among that group that this potential purchase by Mr. Murdoch might jeopardize what amounts to the editorial independence integrity.
I mean, when I hear someone these days talking about editorial independence and integrity, I just love it because I'm a nostalgia buff myself.
Success After Death. In this half hour, I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Lynn Neary. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross tells us that going gentle into that good night is no reason to postpone your goals for personal and career achievement.
How to dress, who to know, and where to eat, where it really counts at the ultimate power lunch.
Also these stories.
Israel, this is Scott Simon reporting.
This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards.
Floundering Israeli economy.
And a prominent scientist tells us UFOs may simply be subway vigilantes from another world.
That and more tonight.
Yeah, April Fools, circa 1985. Pretty clever. I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback. I just want to say a quick word about Goodbye Saigon, the story we're about to hear. Now, even though it aired 25 years ago, in 1985, people here at NPR still talk about it. It's thought of as kind of the gold standard of radio documentaries. They refer to it as that helicopter pilot story, and everybody seems to know what that means. As a side note, it is 25 minutes long, and so you might need to make some extra time to hear the whole thing. Goodbye Saigon was produced by our Playback friends, Noah Adams and Art Silverman, and it features the story of Second Lieutenant Richard Vandegeer. Several weeks after Richard Vandegeer recorded the audio diary you'll hear, on May 15, 1975, his helicopter was shot down during a rescue mission in Vietnam. His name is the very last on the Vietnam War Memorial. Here's Noah Adams.
10 years ago today, the last American was lifted by helicopter off the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, ending America's long and painful involvement in Vietnam. This story is about that last day and about the people who were able to get out then on American helicopters and those who were left behind. It's also the story of an American pilot who flew one of those helicopters. His name is Richard Vandegeer, Air Force Second Lieutenant Vandegeer. In May 1975, he sat down and talked into a tape recorder. He was making a cassette to send home to his best friend. He needed someone to talk to. He'd had a busy month. Before Vietnam, there had been Cambodia. Vandegeer and his helicopter had helped to evacuate people from the Cambodian capital of Phnom Penh. It was an experience that left him drained. He went on military leave, rest and recreation in Bangkok, Thailand. He had just checked into a hotel room.
So the moment I walked into the room, I told him I wanted flowers in the room, and I wanted some gin. But I wanted the best body massage that Bangkok had to offer. And a place and a woman for me. And keep in mind, I had been up about 40 hours and I was still having flashbacks of Phnom Penh.
Those flashbacks of Phnom Penh He wanted to burn them out of his mind. And maybe if he got enough sleep, drank enough gin, and had that body massage, maybe he could forget about it. But it was not to be. The front desk called with a message from headquarters.
The message said that there would be a plane waiting for me at the airport at 1700 to take me back. Of course, it was hard to believe that there could be such injustice in the world. But be assured there is. I really didn't have a good idea why I was being recalled. I had no clear idea as to what was going on. But we felt as though it had something to do with Saigon.
He was right. It was Saigon. A lot of people wanted to get out before the communists took over. Everyone had heard rumors. A bloodbath would follow. There would be acts of revenge for those who worked with the Americans. Some Vietnamese had already left. The American military airlifted them out of the country on cargo planes. But on that last day, the North Vietnamese destroyed the airport runway.
The ground and artillery attack on the Tham Sanut base came at 4 o'clock in the morning.
And all of a sudden, boom, boom, background explosions, and then the building started shattering.
At an airport gymnasium, State Department officer Joe McBride was at work processing refugees.
The phosphorescent bulbs in the ceiling were coming crashing down, and one, including one that came down and crashed on my head, and I said, oh, shit.
Peter Arnett worked for the Associated Press. He had seen more of the war in Vietnam than most reporters.
We were all in the Caravelle Hotel, and there was this enormous shelling and explosions from the direction of the airport. I remember opening my window, and the night sky was lit up with explosives. I went to the roof of the Caravelle Hotel, and there were dozens of newsmen there.
And we could see black plumes of smoke coming up from Tham Sanut Airport.
You could see the muzzle flashes.
And in the next half hour, we saw three aircraft shot down by rockets.
What they were doing was the North Vietnamese were telling the Americans and the South Vietnamese that Tham Sanut was no longer a conduit out of the Republic of South Vietnam.
U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington was at the airport.
My reaction was that, well, this is it. We're going. And to me, the phrase, we're going, meant that we were going to leave the Republic of Vietnam by helicopter.
On the morning of April 29, 1975, Jack Cahill, a reporter for the Toronto Star, was in Saigon waiting for a prearranged signal to tell him the final evacuation had begun.
Well, we were supposed to be all waiting to hear White Christmas being played on the FM radio. That was the signal for the evacuation.
That was a part of the plan. We call it the plan, in quotes.
U.S. Army Captain Stuart Harrington.
The plan said that we were going to signal everyone when it was time to assemble at the safe sites. And the signal that the evacuation was on and that Americans should discreetly report to these safe sites was to be the playing of Bing Crosby's White Christmas, accompanied by the phrase that the temperature in Saigon is 105 and rising, or something like that.
And only the Americans were supposed to know that, you know?
American Julie Forsythe, she was a Quaker worker in Saigon.
Now you can imagine how long only the Americans knew that. Maybe 10 minutes. You know, we heard about it from other Vietnamese people. We didn't hear about it from the Americans.
Very early in the morning, a friend of mine, a doctor, a Vietnamese doctor, he came over to my home very early and he said, now we have to get out of Vietnam very quickly, otherwise we'll be trapped in.
Lê Thị An, like many other Vietnamese, she was frightened. She was forced into making agonizing decisions.
I tried to select things, but we can bring only 20 kilos. How can we bring? My mother wanted to take the incense bowl in my father's altar. In our house, we have an altar to the ancestors. And I pray for my father. I say, we are leaving you. And I asked him to protect us in our crossing of the ocean, but I felt so guilty because I know that from that day on, we will no longer be Vietnamese, you see.
Many Vietnamese made the painful decision to give up their country that morning. On this last day of the war, helicopter pilot Van de Geer was on the aircraft carrier Midway, waiting with other American helicopter pilots for orders to begin the evacuation.
The Vietnamese Huey flew out toward sea and found the carrier. And the man who got out of this aircraft was quoted as saying approximately a week earlier that any South Vietnamese that left the country were cowards, and that everybody should remain in South Vietnam and fight to the bitter end. This man was General Key. Now, I really don't have any personal feelings about, you know, the war over here. I really don't care one way or the other. But I did find myself feeling that I wish he had been shot down.
But Vandegeer soon had to put thoughts of the flamboyant Nguyen Cao Ky out of his mind. The orders had finally come down. Vandegeer and the other helicopter pilots climbed into their aircraft and headed off toward Saigon, 40 minutes away by air. Late in the morning, Canadian reporter Jack Cahill was still doing his job covering the news. As he did, Vietnamese on motorbikes and on foot carrying suitcases made him sense it was time to go.
But it was all terribly confusing. Nobody ever heard White Christmas or anything being played, and nobody knew where to go or what to do. But anyway, I filed my story, walked back to the hotel, and everybody had gone.
In Saigon, TV cameraman Barry Fox was standing with other reporters next to an evacuation bus. The bus was lost and had been circling around the city for hours. It ended up at the Saigon riverfront.
And it was at that point that I suddenly realized that the air was full of helicopters. And I looked up and there were just dozens of helicopters flying over the port. So we got back on the bus, and that at that time created amongst the now panicking Vietnamese who were at the port when we got there. They saw the bus leaving, they wanted to get on the bus. They were trying to climb in the windows of the bus, and people were hanging onto the outside, and the driver drove away. We slow down to go out the gate, and a woman carrying a baby jumps on. The bus doesn't stop, and nobody's stopping. And we, you know, the general, there's an air of hysteria. And she loses her grip on her baby, and the baby falls off the bus, and then she jumps off the bus, and the bus, as far as I could gather, ran over the baby.
Fear made people do terrible things on that last day. But along with hysteria, there were acts of courage. State Department Officer Joe McBride saw a little of both. His job was to drive people from points around the city to evacuation pickup spots. McBride remembers it was almost impossible to organize an orderly departure because the evacuees were afraid of being left behind. However, McBride recalls one exception.
There was a big Vietnamese that had a civilian clothes, big tall Vietnamese, spoke good English, came up to me, and as I was trying to organize things, and said, "Maybe I can help you." And he said, "What are your priorities?" And I laid out my priorities as best I could. And he said, fine, I'll take care of it. I came back four or five times after that guy started organizing things, and he would generally have a group of people lined up and organized, and I'd take them. I turned to him and I'd say, "Look, I'm running out of gas. I'm running out of time. The choppers are leaving. This is going to be the last run." And I asked the guy, where's your family? And it's you and your family now. He said, "We can't do it." I said, "What do you mean?" He says, "I've got 24 people in my family. There's no way we can do it in just one run." And I said, they told me I've got to go home. And the guy just said, "Well, it's been nice working with you." Extended his hand, shook mine, and said, "See you around. Thanks for trying."
I made 3 sorties into Saigon. No, 4 sorties, I'm sorry. I could tell you about how real the fear was that I felt. The VC had commandeered Air America Hueys, and they were flying them around, which simply made a very interesting chess game.
As the day wore on, it became clear that promises would have to be broken. Promises to Vietnamese who had worked for the Americans that they would get out on this final day. There were delays in the helicopter lifts. The plan was falling apart. The North Vietnamese were surrounding the city. A young Vietnamese woman, Chung Won Lem, worked for the South Vietnamese government. An American friend was supposed to tell her when it was time to evacuate. She waited, but didn't hear from him.
For me, that was the last blow. So I decided that I have to go to the embassy. So I tried to make my way to the Marine, and I asked one of the Marine, I said, could I go in the embassy? And the Marine said, there's no one in embassy now, except people who have been accepted to go there to wait for the helicopters. Do you have a pass? And I said, no, I don't. And so the Marine said, then in that case, I'm sorry.
People have brought their possessions and their bundles and whatever was important to them, and we're trying to carry them through the crowd.
I have my wife standing with my two children, and I try to get in to the gate, but they give us a warning that anyone try to break in, they're going to shoot to death.
I saw all the newsmen with their equipment and so on, and that also gave me a feel that, in fact, the situation was desperate. Otherwise, news people would not leave.
It was just solid Vietnamese, shoulder to shoulder, pushing, shouting.
I got to the side gate and I wanted to get over.
The State Department's Joe McBride, back at the embassy after picking up all the Vietnamese he could.
Obviously, they couldn't open that gate. And the Marine said, no, sir, I can't let you over. I said, why not? He says, if you do, they'll start coming and then I'll have to shoot. I don't want to have to shoot them, sir. Please don't come over.
I could see from what was going on around me that the embassy was getting worried as to how it was going to survive the onslaught of all these people. The absolute knowledge that there was no way the helicopters were going to get all these people out of the compound.
I circulated through the crowd, walking gently, pushing through, excuse me, don't worry, there's plenty of helicopters for everybody, all this in Vietnamese, of course. We're not going to abandon, don't worry. Just didn't want panic to start. And quietly gathered about 25 or 30 Americans who were out there with their dependents. And at that point, the two Marines came over the gate, and they must have been 6'2", 6'5". They were big, big men wearing the flak jackets and the helmets. The Marines kept pushing the crowd back. Every time we'd let somebody else through, particularly a Vietnamese with an American, people waving papers and, you know, testimonies, why they had to get out, stories, and we're doing everything we can do to keep the panic down, and I'm assuring everybody constantly. And every once in a while, the Marines will lock and load their rifles, you know, with the bolts to make a snapping sound, scare people back, and I'm thinking, God, these guys are cool. So all it would have taken is one panicked person with a grenade, one person going out of their mind with a knife.
Originally, the U.S. Embassy was not among the general evacuation points at all. It was to be reserved as the way out for the ambassador and his staff. However, by late afternoon, it had become an irresistible last hope for Vietnamese wanting to leave. More than 6,000 of them had gotten out by way of a safe corner of the city's Thanh Sanut Airport and other spots. But with nightfall, the helicopters had stopped going to those places, but were still coming to the embassy compound. The 1,000 who had found their way inside the walls considered themselves lucky.
Repeatedly, we told these folks, if you'll all cooperate, we'll all go. But these choppers cannot take your suitcases. Please throw them all away. I mean, these people were good. They threw away everything. The only people we had problems with, ironically, were Americans. And the number of Americans in the crowd before we got rid of them all argued that, you know, this is my right, or, you know, I'll write my congressman, and groused about it. But the Vietnamese were good. They were docile and cooperative once we got them under control.
We thought that they were going to call off the operation when it became dark, because we never expected them to send us into such a bad situation to begin with, even if it was daytime. But as you probably know, they continued the mission on until nearly 5 o'clock in the morning. The night sorties were the worst because we flew lights out. The tracers kept everybody on edge. To see a city burning gives one a strange feeling of insecurity.
At the embassy, Americans had been delaying their own departures as long as they could to keep the helicopters coming for the Vietnamese. But Washington was ordering them to get out. The CIA's Frank Snipp.
The halls were overrun with humanity because the evacuation was going off the roof at this point. There were helicopters going off the roof. And the embassy had become a labyrinth of humanity. People were hungry. They had animals tucked under their arms. They were screaming for water. And we pushed our way through them as we made our way up the stairwell towards the helicopter pad. I felt such shame because we were leaving before the Vietnamese in that embassy.
The State Department's Joe McBride.
I was ready to leave. I'd done what could be done. In any case, whoever was loading said, "We need a couple. Joe, how about you? You're ready." It was all red inside. The chopper was all red. It was like the night lights that they would use on a submarine or something. And this is a very high-pitched whine that I'd never heard before. Incredible, like a turbine kind of whining sound. And the back gate was down enough that when the helicopter lifted off, and by the time it had lifted off and we were heading out over Saigon, it was dark. And you could see fires in the city. You could see fires in a lot of places.
It was now a little after 5 in the morning, Saigon time, April 30th, 1975. The helicopters were coming further apart, but a final 6 of them were due in. That would be enough to handle the remaining 420 Vietnamese citizens waiting in the embassy courtyard. Waiting with them were Captain Stuart Harrington, Colonel John Madison, and another Army officer. Captain Harrington describes what happened next.
The senior Marine on the scene was a Major Jim Keane. And Keane came out of the embassy, went up to Colonel Madison and said, "Sir, the evacuation's over. It's Americans only." And Colonel Madison looked at Keane. I was standing right there. And he said, "No way. We have these 420 people here, and we were promised that there'd be the 6 more lifts that we need, and we're not leaving until they're gone." And Keane said, "Can't do it." He said, "It's a presidential order, and I'm not going to risk the safety of my men any longer," his men who were around the perimeter of the embassy. Madison said, "I'll take it up with the ambassador." And Keane went, "You can't, sir. He just left." And he pointed to a CH-46 that was leaving and just taken off, was about 50 feet in the air above the roof of the embassy. Good soldier that he was, Colonel Madison made that call. He said, "Okay, Stu, you stay here with the radio, with these people, and play like everything's normal, and we'll slip into the embassy and get up to the roof, and you make it up to the roof when you can." So I went to the trunk deck of a car that had its headlights on, pointed, and where the people were all, you know, I'm sitting here, the people were 5 feet away, the first row. And I sat there with this radio, talking to helicopters that weren't there, and the people kept saying, "Dai Wei, Dai Wei, Kho Truc Thang Hong. Is the helicopter coming?" And I would tell them, "Don't go la, don't worry. Kho Truc Thang Lun, Sap Toi, a big helicopter is coming. Don't worry, don't worry." And I did that for 5 or 10 minutes until I thought I'd given them enough time. So I put the radio down and I said to the Vietnamese nearest to me, "Mac Dai," which means I got to take a leak. And I slipped over into the bushes and then I made a quick move and into the door of the embassy and charged up the stairs.
Captain Harrington ran up to the embassy roof, climbed aboard a partially filled helicopter, and left. Now, after 16 years of fighting, the American presence in the Republic of South Vietnam was down to 11 Marines. There was a long wait for another helicopter. The Marines thought they had been forgotten. When it did come, they knew they had to make a run for it. The question was, could they get to the roof before the Vietnamese? Sergeant Terry Bennington.
Well, we backed in slowly initially, and then when they realized what we were doing, they started for us, and we headed for the door. And I think we beat them with maybe a second to spare. And we got the door shut and got it barred. And, of course, that wasn't going to hold them that long, and we knew that. So everybody got up onto the roof at that time. And then we barred the doors on the roof, and there were still, you know, it didn't take long for the Vietnamese to get through the door and come up that ladder well. So we took CS gas, and we took red smoke and green smoke and any other smoke we could get our hands on, and it did work. Once we threw the red smoke and the CS gas and everything, they started running. Unfortunately, the turbines of the engine started to suck the CS gas inside of the chopper, so we kind of gassed ourselves there too. But the chopper pilot finally looked back, and I think he saw what was happening, and he got us out of there pretty quick. Definitely got us out of there pretty quick.
The evacuation has now been completed. The President commends the personnel of the armed forces who accomplished it, as well as Ambassador Graham Martin and the staff of his mission, who served so well under difficult conditions. This action closes a chapter in the American experience.
When I saw the last helicopter left the top of the U.S. embassy, I felt I was not really angry, but hurt. Like, you know, you trust you are a really good friend. You think that you have been having a good friend. You work together for so long. And when you are in danger or in hardship, they even, you know, instead of helping you, they turn their back away.
We pulled out, meaning a special operations unit, close to 2,000 people. We couldn't pull out anymore because it was beyond human endurance to go anymore. I'm back now. I got back today. I am in bits and pieces, fairly incoherent only because it's been such a fast pace. I have no word on when I will be withdrawn. I haven't had a chance to feel it out, really. I'll just have to wait and see.
But Air Force Second Lieutenant Richard Vandegeer had one more helicopter rescue after he made this tape. When the Cambodians seized the SS Mayaguez in May of 1975, Vandegeer was again called into action. He was airlifting a squadron of Marines when a rocket hit his helicopter. At the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, where the names of the dead are listed chronologically, Richard Vandegeer's name is last.
Again, Dick, I apologize for the very poor way that I have explained to you what has been happening. I don't think it will be too terribly long before we are together again. I wish you peace, and I have great deal of faith that the future has to be ours. Adios, my friend.
I'm Carrie Thompson, and you're listening to Playback.